few years, the entire world will be convulsed in a war that would cost millions of lives and countless billions of dollars and redraw the map of all of Europe and of all of the world, as far as that's concerned. And that war would go from battles in East Africa to all of the Middle East, to the Balkans, to the Carpathian Mountains, to Belgium, the Netherlands, France, and the Lowlands, and that would actually cost many American lives, although we only lost about half the number of lives in World War I than we did in the Civil War, believe it or not, and then we lost twice the number of lives in World War II than we did in the Civil War. But who could have predicted it? Nobody knew that was going to happen. Nobody knew it would be a pretext of the assassination of one of the crown prince of the Habsburg Empire, Austro-Hungarian Empire, in an open automobile in Sarajevo that would bring about World War I. But that's what happened. And most people would never have guessed that the United States would have become involved until the sinking of a ship in which Americans died. And of course, Woodrow Wilson was trying to keep us out, but eventually we got involved. Who could have known in the summer of 1941, when the sentiment in the United States was isolationist and anti-war, let's not get involved in another one of Europe's wars, let's not send our young boys over there. If you remember, it was very late, I think even as late as November, if memory serves, I might be wrong on that, when the U.S. Congress passed by only one law, the Selective Service Act, in 1941, or we wouldn't have even had any kind of an Army, Navy, Marine Corps to begin to withstand the Japanese once they attacked. Now, even though Billy Mitchell had written about the possibility of an attack on Pearl Harbor many years earlier, he was a maverick that got in a lot of trouble with the higher echelon of the military for even saying such things, but it was not lost on the Japanese when the British attacked the Gulf of Taranto. And they did so with the old bi-wing Swordfish aircraft, but they had to reprogram the way those torpedoes acted because the Gulf of Taranto, that's between the heel and the sole of the Italian boot, where huge, big Italian battleships were moored in a comparatively shallow anchorage. And the British Swordfish biplanes went in there with torpedoes and just sent so many of them to the bottom and, of course, heavily damaged others. They virtually annihilated a major portion of the Italian fleet. The Japanese got that lesson. And so here they came on December 7, 1941, and everyone in the Western world was absolutely shocked. Admiral Kimmel, General Short, were caught with their trousers down, so to speak, and they were both sacked and immediately replaced out of the debacle at Pearl Harbor. How good are you at guessing the future? Would anyone like to make a guess that Russia will not at some time enter in? Would you bet on that? Would you bank on that? That this war will not widen. It won't widen into Macedonia. It won't spill over into Bosnia-Herzegovina. The Bulgarians won't get involved. The Romanians won't get involved because they're a part of NATO. Let's look at it from the Serbian point of view for just a moment. As you well know, for more than 45, close to 50 years following World War II, the Warsaw Pact and NATO were at loggerheads. They were the two opposing alliances. Mutual defense pacts is what they were. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization was actually established by Winston Churchill and Roosevelt aboard an American cruiser up in the waters off of Nova Scotia during World War II. It is purely a military alliance. It means North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Why would Romania and Bulgaria, signing on wanting to become a member now of NATO, where is Bulgaria in relation to the North Atlantic? All right, look at it, if you can, without any justification, without any exoneration of terrorism, of the savagery of some of the Serb policemen who have committed atrocities in Kosovo, because two wrongs don't make a right. Poison plus poison doesn't equal a very wonderful drink. So having said that up front, there is such a thing as two points of view. There are always two sides to every conflict, and sometimes there are three and four and five and more to every conflict, whether it's a domestic one in between husband and wife and children, family, distant family, whether it's church, whether it's politics, I don't care. There are always two sides. And believe it or not, usually perfectly rational, intelligent, and reasonable people, based upon their own education and their own cultural, historic, religious, political background, can have very honestly held opinions which are exactly in conflict and the exact opposite of other equally honestly held opinions. The people whom you and I might say are wrong do not get up every morning and say how wonderful it is to be wrong. They believe with all their heart that they are right. Now, for just a quick moment, and I could take 2 to 3 to 5 sermons to talk about this, and I won't. If you were just to look up again the immense loss of life suffered by the Soviet Union during World War II, I've heard everything from 30 million to 40 million, but far more by Russia alone than all other nations put together during World War II. The savage attack of Hitler that rolled completely across all of Russia right to the gates of Moscow, the tremendous stand that they made of what they call Rodina or Mother Russia, and the fact that they were husbanding resources way back in Irkutsk and clear way back in the hinterland, and brought them up, and the women were out there with rifles and shovels and all the rest of it, fighting alongside their men. If you look at what they lost, you look at who attacked them and who supported it, and then you look at their history of the Bolshevist Revolution and what happened prior to that time and why it was that the Tsar abdicated, and then you realize that they are paranoid about neighbors who want to attack them and take over their territory. Now, you look at World War II and its outcome, at whether or not Russia had any right, from its point of view, to occupy Berlin, to place its troops in places like Poland and East Germany. Why would the Russians want to do that? Well, let's ask, why would the United States want to have a naval base in Guantanamo and Cuba? Guantanamo and Cuba. Why does the United States now have not something like 12 various places around the world in which we had troops garrisoned and stationed only about 2 or 3 years ago, but 28 places all over the world today where U.S. troops are garrisoned, including Korea, Germany, Panama, and places all over the globe? Because of hegemony, because of a buffer zone, because of the possibility of being attacked. And so the Soviets wanted to have their armor out there in Eastern Germany and in Poland instead of on the Rodina soil. They put together what is called a Warsaw Pact. And the Warsaw Pact consisted of all those Eastern European nations of Czechoslovakia and Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, Yugoslavia, East Germany, of course, and the Soviet Union garrisoned all of that with all of their tanks and troops. Now, when the Soviet Union imploded, basically an economic implosion, and the wall came down, and very, very quickly, in a matter of a very few months, those incredible changes took place in Eastern Europe. Unimaginable when you stop to think about it. And the fact that they were bloodless, with the exception of the assassination of the Ceausescu family, who were the dictators in Romania, that all these other countries, Bulgaria, Hungary, all of them, opted to put in democratic reforms and to dismantle a state-owned, state-run, complete stifling autocracy and to start allowing would-be entrepreneurs and capitalists to bid on such things as railways and airlines and steel factories and collective farms and on, and begin to become a market economy and change over into a democratic government. Well, little by little, the Russians, now retreating into Russia proper and seeing all kinds of little nations start up, like Chechnya, which they, you know, tried to prevent, and the Ukraine, and of course Belarus, he's the former Belarusia, and Azerbaijan, and Armenia, and all these other countries. That's why they were trying to do what they did in Afghanistan, because it's right on their border. Of course, we supplied the Afghans, and Russia failed in that. That was their Vietnam. But Afghanistan was a whole lot closer to Russia than Vietnam was to the United States. You've got to admit that as well. So from the Russian point of view, as you see NATO steadily advancing eastward, and you see nations that used to be Warsaw Pact nations signing on board NATO, if any one of the NATO countries are attacked, we will come to their aid. If we are attacked, all the NATO countries will come to our aid. How would you feel, looking at it purely from the Russian point of view, if you see this encirclement by what to you is a potentially hostile force, purely a military alliance of a mutual defense pact between all those countries, and you see it going right down into the Balkans. How would you feel? Maybe that'll give you a little bit of a clue of how some of the Russians feel about it. Now, because my daughter-in-law is Serb-Croat, and her father is Serb, and her mother was Croatian, is Croatian, and her father died early last year, and because she was over there with two of my grandchildren who are here in this room, and spent 1 month in Novi Sad last summer, and then I hear, as she talked to her sister, about bombs going off right within sight and sound, shook their apartment just like a major earthquake, it comes home very differently when I watch the news. I'm kind of glued to the television set, as you could well imagine Deanna was, and she underwent a lot of very nervous hours until she could get in touch because all the telephones were down and she couldn't get through for about the first day and a half or so. But she finally did get through to her sister, and thanks be to God, they are all right. Why would the Serbs want anything to do with Kosovo? Why can't the Kosovars or the Kosovars, Kosovan, whatever they're called, people in Kosovo who are called ethnic Albanians, just have the country? Why do the Serbs want to hang on to it? It's not that big of a parcel of land. Well, if you look it up, look at a little history of it, there is some petroleum products there, some machinery, some mining. It's mostly agrarian. They do have some exports. They share a long border with Albania. Albania, as you know, is the only nation in all of the Balkans or Europe, which is virtually 100%, it's over 70-some percent, Islamic, where the Islamic faith or religion is in the majority. Many of the Albanians that have gone into Kosovo are there illegally. Some of them are second-generation illegals, but they never immigrated legally, and they are there illegally. This is a point made by the Serbs. If you study Serbian history, you will learn that there was a battle clear back in 1389 where Prince Lazar I, with his forces, opted to stand and fight in what is called the Field of Blackbirds in a valley that goes up right near Pristina, the capital, which means what it says, beautiful. It merely means pristine or beautiful. And he opted to die when the Ottoman Turks were invading. Austria had invaded, and the Ottomans were fighting, and the Serbs were caught in between. The instant I mentioned him, my daughter-in-law came up with the date. She knew exactly that date. I was amazed that Deanna knew that, because this is taught to school children. We learn about everybody from, we learn a lot of mythology, of course, like Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492 and discovered America, which is utter nonsense. But later on, we learn about the Vinelanders and Eric the Red, and we learn that there were people who had colonized the United States long before Columbus was ever born. But we do learn our mythology, and we hear about George Washington, who said, "I cannot tell a lie," different from some of our current leadership, and said he could, that he did cut down the cherry tree. But in any event, those people learn things that go back way before the United States was ever thought of. Many, many, many times the age of our country, and they are steeped in that tradition. So Kosovo is like a holy ground, an area where their churches are still there. There are many churches of the Serb Orthodox. You might as well say Russian Orthodox and Serb Orthodox are exactly the same. They share the same dialect, not the dialect, a little different, same language, same alphabet, and they're virtually the same peoples. So they say in Serbia, and I've been tapping into their chat rooms and listening to what some of the Serbs are saying about it, reading some of their mail on email, and their justification for what is going on over there. And it's kind of interesting. I published one of the Serb letters in the upcoming World Watch for you to read, so you get a point of view, because this one man made the same point that I had earlier thought about. How would we feel if the Mexicans were demanding half of Texas back? And so I relate that in the article, at least to give that point of view. Again, say it over and over and over again. You can never justify genocide, ethnic cleansing, brutality like that the Serb police and army has heaped upon some of those poor people from Albania, or the people who were simply second and third generation residents of Kosovo who perhaps have the same religion as those in Albania. Well, Bible prophecy did not predict the Hundred Years' War. It didn't predict the Seven Years' War. It didn't predict the Napoleonic Wars. It didn't predict the American Revolutionary War or the Spanish-American War. It didn't predict World War I or World War II. And Bible prophecy did not predict what is happening in Kosovo today. But the Bible does say there would be a time of wars and rumors of wars, and we're certainly living in that time, and it does talk about major wars to come in the Middle East. I want to talk about United States commitments around the world and whether or not what Christ said about Israel and Jerusalem would be a factor, even if you think that the United States and the British Commonwealth of Nations are not part of the Lost Ten Tribes of Israel. I think anyone in his right mind that knows anything at all about World War II, recent history, the development of the Jewish state from 1948 onward, American commitments, the fact that there are far more Jews in New York and Los Angeles combined than there are in all of Israel, the tremendous number of Jewish people throughout government, especially in finance, in industry, in business, in the entertainment field in the United States, the billions of dollars that go pouring into Israeli coffers from American direct aid, as well as all the many, many Jewish organizations and institutions that are sending private money, that included my own father, who gave them all kinds of money to build a park and all kinds of things for their great dig. American members of God's church were tithing, and the tithe money was going to Israel to do various things over there along the cultural lines, you know, the archaeological dig and so on. So when you look at the deep involvement between the United States and the modern nation of Israel, you and I both know that any nation that would attack Israel would immediately cause the United States to become involved. Now, you all know, and I've told you time and again, that during the entirety of the Cold War, men, almost universally, of the Protestant evangelical televangelists were all saying that Russia is the beast and Russia is going to attack Palestine. That's because they didn't understand Ezekiel 38 and 39 about Gog and Magog, and they didn't read about what it says, that it would be a time when the land was at peace and had been brought back from the edge of the sword, and that that great battle where Gog and Magog come into the Middle East is even after the time of the second coming of Christ. They confuse that and make that the Battle of Armageddon or even before. I was told this by Mr. James Lamb, that a friend of his actually heard in person Hal Lindsey say that we were wrong, all of us who were saying that Russia was going to invade Palestine, and that the only people who were saying that it would be Europe that would unite and would eventually come in there were the Armstrongs. He told me that just when I was over in Nashville, that Hal Lindsey had said that publicly. And I questioned him specifically about it. Did he really say that? He said, yes. Hal Lindsey, who wrote a best-selling book, you know, The Late Great Planet Earth, and had all these prophetic scenarios about Russia invading Palestine, said that only the Armstrongs were saying that Russia will not invade Palestine, but that very likely Germany at some time will. If you'll turn to Daniel, the 11th chapter, and refresh our memory again with regard to this one major prophecy, again, I say that all prophecy looks out at the rest of the world from the vantage point of the Middle East. Now, the Balkans are not that close to the Middle East, but as you know, the Balkans, if you look at all those nations there, bordering the Black Sea where the Danube empties into the Black Sea, coming down to Greece and Macedonia and European Turkey, where the Bosporus and Dardanelles provide a warm water access to the Mediterranean Sea for the Russian fleet, then you know that truly it is the crossroads of the world. I've gone over this time and again, so a lot of you are familiar with the time, verse 40, that back in ancient history, after the breakup of the kingdom that Alexander started, the Greco-Macedonian Empire, into four different parts, which is predicted in the fourth chapter of the book of Daniel and also the seventh chapter, that the Seleucidae of Syria and the Ptolemies of Egypt were warring across Palestine time and again at each other. And the king of the north at that time was Antiochus Epiphanes, and the king of the south was Ptolemy Soter. Well, this is a prophecy for the time of the end. So any battles that took place way back in ancient history, even prior to the emergence of the Roman Empire, are not implied here as being the fulfillment of this prophecy, because all of prophecy is dual. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. Who is the king of the south? I don't know, and neither does anyone else. Not a single leader of any of the breakaway groups, many of whom are paying little, if any, attention to prophecy, although one or two of them are, and I think the one that claims to be the Philadelphia Church of God has a rather elaborate prophetic scenario worked out and feel that they are somehow involved in it. I think some of them still believe in a place of safety. Not a one of them can tell me who is the king of the South. They can speculate, but I can do that, and so can you. Is it Mubarak? Will there be another attempt at a UAR, United Arab Republic? How could it be Iraq and Saddam Hussein when he is a whole lot closer to where the Seleucidae held forth than he is to Egypt? It was always an Egyptian in the past. A lesser line of pharaohs called the Ptolemies. And it probably will be again. Could it conceivably be a leader of Saudi Arabia? Maybe. What about Yemen? I don't know. What about the UAR, for pity's sake? What about Qatar? Or Abu Dhabi? I guess you'd say Dubai or Bahrain. You'd take your pick. It could be one of the Arab Gulf states, but I doubt that somehow. We don't see that man. We don't know who he is. He doesn't seem to have any power or coalition of Arab states as yet. Now, what happened just the other day to remind you of something in history? So you know what the strategic interests are in that region of the world. People have already rather sardonically said there isn't any oil in Kosovo that the United States is interested in. But there was in the Gulf, wasn't there? And obviously it was all about oil. 70% to Japan, 46% to Europe, 17% to the United States coming from the Gulf ports and from Saudi Arabia. So any coalition of states in that area is a grave concern to all of Europe, to Japan, and to the United States, to every really great industrialized nation in the world, because it is the repository of the vast resources of energy, and the majority of them, for the whole world, right there in the Gulf and Saudi Arabia. At the time of the end shall the king of the South push at him. Not a one of those leaders can write to me or call me and give me his name. They can't even tell me of which race or nation he will come. They can speculate, and as I said, so can you, but they can't come up with a name. When it happens, I believe you and I will know. If some move of a pact or a coalition, some uniting of Arab states together into a solid bloc occurs, and those Arabs seem to have their hands on oil, it will be of great concern to all of Europe and the United States and to Japan. Now, just recently, within days ago, OPEC decided to once again, just like the De Beers has always controlled diamonds, diamonds would be as cheap as probably man-made diamonds if they wanted to flood the market with them, but they control it by just letting them out in little bits and pieces to keep the price where it is. OPEC does the same thing with oil. So now your gasoline prices are going up all of a sudden. Even though it's about 3 months lagging, the pump will hit it right now today, just like when the Schlitz beer factory went out of business back over here several years ago in Longview. The people that stored up on Schlitz, they knew that several months from that time on it's going to be hard to get, so they jacked the price up instantly. That's what they did at the pumps, and that's what they're going to be doing. Because OPEC, the oil-producing nations of the Gulf, have decided unanimously, in order to get the price of oil back up, to hold down on production because there is a worldwide oil glut. So, hark back to 1973 and before. It was stated by members of our Congress, oh, the Arabs in OPEC will never use oil as a political weapon. I think that was in March or April of that year, and what was it, November or something, when they clamped down a complete oil embargo. And I don't know if the guy ever ate his words, but he should have. And you remember that because I got into those lines. I used to have people, remember Mr. Bill Evans would help me out and would say, would you like me to take your car? It's going to take about 4 hours to get gasoline. I said, well, thanks a lot, Bill. And he sat there for 4 hours inching forward to get the gas filled up, the tank filled up, when we had that terrible shortage because everybody was hoarding it. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at this king of the north, at him. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. Now who is the king of the north? I don't know. I believe it is the beast power. It used to be Antiochus Epiphanes, who was like a successor of Alexander the Great. And he is a type of Adolf Hitler. If you will turn back a little bit in this chapter to verse 20. Then shall stand up in his estate, and you'd have to go to Rawlinson's Five Great Empires and Dorothy Ruth Miller's Ancient History and Bible Light to get a lot of this. Plus, there is something in some of the other books, and some of the commentaries have some information on it. A raiser of taxes in the glory of his kingdom. I remember this much about it. His name was Heliodorus. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. In his case, I think he was poisoned. In the case of Kaiser Wilhelm, he abdicated, and I've forgotten, my memory is faint on that, as to how he died. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably, or in a time of peace, and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. My father always thought, and I have thought, since the person who was the raiser of taxes, Heliodorus, was superseded by Antiochus Epiphanes, who is the vile person. In their language, Epiphany means great forthcoming or great revealing, and is a name of great aplomb. But Epimenes means idiot. And because of his personality, a lot of people called him Antiochus Epimenes instead of Antiochus Epiphanes. It was a play on words. You can look that up in biblical history. Because the Hohenzollerns, the Kaisers, was of a family called the German Hohenzollern. All right, you when you go to a border, we used to go, you know, driving all over Europe, you come to the Zoll, Z-O-L-L, or Zollern, Z-O-L-L-E-R-N. Hohenzollern merely meant man or person who was a tax collector. Heliodorus was a tax collector. The Hohenzollern meant tax collector. The one who superseded Kaiser Wilhelm, not immediately because you had the Weimar Republic and so on, but eventually came in to be the Führer and the dictator of all of Germany, was Adolf Hitler. And he certainly did come in and obtain the kingdom by flattering the German people and by all of his promises and so on, and in a time of comparative peace, although war clouds were gathering everywhere, and he was the one causing most of it. So I have always thought, since the last personality to be identified in this lengthy 11th chapter of the book of Daniel was Antiochus Epiphanes, and that Antiochus Epiphanes seems to be a type of Adolf Hitler, and that even though Hitler has long since been dead, there is going to come a super dictator at the helm of 10 nations in Europe, and we've always felt it would be a German, because in most cases in history, during the time of the Holy Roman Empire, it was a Germanic kingdom, and that this will be the fulfillment of the beast power. So likely, that explains why I think, I could be wrong, but I really think, and it doesn't depend, our salvation doesn't depend upon it, that the King of the North is going to be a German who is the beast power, who will be like a super dictator over 10 nations. Now he comes against him like a whirlwind. Of course, you can read aircraft, chariots, you can read tanks, and horsemen, armored cavalry, and with many ships, well, ships are ships, and he shall enter into the countries, plural, and shall overflow and pass over. The Bible used a symbol of a river that would overflow its banks as armies that would overflow borders. He shall enter also into the glorious land. So this is depicting an attack by some kind of a northern power into Palestine. The mistake that Hal Lindsey and others made was immediately thinking of the present status quo in the 60s and 70s of the Soviet Union and the Cold War. And if you only think that, and if you're missing the most vital ingredient to understanding all of Bible prophecy, which is the knowledge of where are the lost 10 tribes, then it would be extremely logical to think that Russia would be the invading power that would come in there, because everybody expected Russia to invade somewhere, maybe through the Fulda Gap, where all the tank battles were fought in World War II, and that would be the most logical place, where it devolves into a very broad valley and they could get tanks through there instead of coming across a lot of the mountainous terrain into the heartland of Europe. And that's where NATO amassed a lot of its forces, because it thought that the Russian tanks would come through the Fulda Gap. So he shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, many of them. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom. That's Turkey, I believe. Edom is Esau, and Esau, we believe, are the Turks. One of the princes of the Edomites was Timon. In the land, it was called the land of Timani. And you know that for all those years when the sheikhs and sharifs and the sultans and so on ruled over Turkey, who was the Sultan who was killed in the Field of Blackbirds? I've forgotten his name. But anyway, he was the first of his line, too, and he was killed along with Lazar. But Edom is Turkey, and Moab, I have always believed, probably the Syrians, and the children of Ammon or Ammon. Ammon are the Jordanians. They are probably the Hashemite Arabs. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Why would those nations, generally to the east of the Jordan River, not be involved? Well, you look at any map today, and you look at where the dividing line is between Jew and Arab. They're coming into Palestine, and they're invading the nation of modern-day Israel. And they're not invading Arab countries. They're omitting Arab countries. Now, that gets down to a question which leads us to a little closer possibility of understanding who might eventually the King of the South be. Since the King of the South is the one who precipitates the reaction by the King of the North, if the King of the South were Saudi Arabia, why would these people stop short of Saudi Arabia? If the King of the South is a Syrian or an Iraqi or a Jordanian, why would they omit all those countries and just come right down where the border is right now between the West Bank and the East Bank and occupy Palestine, but not occupy the Arab countries? That's why I say I've always thought, tended to think, that it will be an Egyptian because of what it says in the next verse. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Now why? He shall have power over the treasures of gold, that's ancient language, and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and push, or it should say Cush and Put, Put and Cush, shall be at his steps. Modern Libya on the Cyrenaican Peninsula is not meant by that, nor is modern Ethiopia, if you can say that Ethiopia is modern. But it very likely means the people of India, who are the people of Cush or Cushites. But when this happens, when this invasion occurs, tidings out of the east and out of the north, what is east and north of there, shall trouble him. You might say this is yesterday's headlines for Clinton to read. He sends NATO forces in to bomb areas around Pristina and, of course, Belgrade, Novi Sad, and all over Yugoslavia. And suddenly, tidings out of the north and east begin to trouble him a little bit. Well, the Prime Minister of Russia turns around, does a 180 over the Atlantic, and goes straight home. Russia begins violent demonstrations against U.S. embassies. Russia invites all NATO envoys out of their land and give them exactly 24 hours to pack up and get out. Russia calls all of its envoys back from Brussels, and Russia begins making very, very strong statements, including Boris Yeltsin's statement that what has been unleashed there could be worse than World War III. Pretty strong words coming from the head of a nation that has tens of thousands of nuclear warheads and tens of thousands of ICBMs and one of the largest armies in the world, wouldn't you say? Tidings out of the north and the east. If you think the White House Situation Room and the Pentagon are not monitoring almost every broadcast, that the satellites aren't tuned in to everything, they put the Red Army on full alert. They want to monitor everything that is said from any command and control center to a guy driving a tank somewhere to find out, is any armor moving south right now while we're sitting here today? And you can't rule that out entirely, can you? You can't really rule out the following possible scenario, that Russia simply decides, our brethren, the Serbs, not only Zhirinovsky and his mercenaries, but the Russian army proper, says, why don't we just send about a third of our tank columns down into Yugoslavia and ring Belgrade and all of it and just dare any NATO aircraft to kill a single Russian soldier or to flame a single Russian tank, knowing that that would precipitate World War III. They could do it, and who would be there to stop them? Who would stop them? There isn't anything to stop them between southern Russia and northern Yugoslavia. They could do it like that. They could be doing it any time. And there wouldn't be anything at all to stop them. Now, I'm merely, you know, borrowing scenarios. This is not the scenario that this prophecy is talking about. I'm just borrowing thoughts that are obvious to anyone who really thinks through the situation right now today as to what could happen. Tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him, and I think that has to do with the prophecies in the book of Revelation about the figurative drying up of the great river Euphrates, which won't stop any kind of armies today, to prepare the way of the kings of the east to the battle of Armageddon. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy, and utterly to make away many, and he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. It's talking about the seas, meaning the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, meaning Jerusalem. And yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. And at that time, I'm going right on deliberately because men have divided it up into chapters and verses, not the original manuscript, shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble. You may as well read a time of great world war, because that is the time of the tribulation, such as never was since there was a nation, even at that same time. And at that time your people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. So in those two verses of Daniel 12, 1 and 2, you have the time from the precipitation, the beginning of the great tribulation, right to the time of the resurrection and the second coming of Jesus Christ, which will take a span of about 3.5 years plus a month or two. Now, if you look right now at the potential in the Balkans for a widening war, and at all of the things that are obtained there, you've got to simply go back, look at recent history, find out who is where, what are the tempers, and who is involved. You know now that Greece, though a member of the UN and NATO, has decried the bombing. It tried to modify it a little bit, but the Greeks are extremely angry. The Greeks claim Macedonia. Macedonia was a southern province of that whole Yugoslavian thing that was put together following the Treaty of Versailles. But they had gotten autonomy, and they're sort of a separate nation. They've got a certain degree of autonomy. We have got, what, 14,000? I think only a few hundred, something like 700, I forget, Americans wearing the blue caps of the UN that are in Macedonia, Skopje, and right across the border. Well, they don't want, none of these nations want, Bulgaria, Romania, and certainly Macedonia, do not want tens of thousands of Kosovars coming across, carrying only what they can on their backs, and have to feed and clothe and shelter them. Because that's why there were some real reactions against the Kurds in Turkey recently, because the Kurds were fleeing Saddam Hussein and just breaking the economic back of the Turkish government to try to provide for them. So they're trying to drive them back where they came from. And the Turks want, as do the Kurds, a separate Kurdish nation. Saddam Hussein doesn't want it because that would cut off a part of his country. So here is Macedonia, a bone of contention between Bulgaria, Greece, the Macedonians themselves, made up of at least four races and three religions, and it is a hot spot where American forces are on the ground. Now, on the first day, the first 24 hours of these bombings, I was sitting there watching CNN. I heard a report that people in the capital of Macedonia had heard a couple of major explosions right there. The first little bit of paranoia was that it was long-range artillery shells being lobbed in there by the Serbs. Immediately, the UN, and you heard the British commander probably, if you saw that particular newscast, said that they were gathering their forces and putting them up along the border. Well, ostensibly, they are there for training, quote-unquote, to get ready to go into Kosovo under the aegis of any kind of an agreement, if they agree to the Rambouillet Agreement, or a new UN agreement of some kind, as peacekeepers in Kosovo to keep the Serbs and the Albanians from each other in the same way that UN peacekeepers are on the ground in Bosnia-Herzegovina, including some of the German troops who were there, and Norwegians and Americans, and you've seen some of them interviewed in the last few days. So any widening of the war that dragged Macedonia in would instantly get the Greeks involved. And if the Greeks get involved, because some of those people are Islamic in Macedonia, as well as Albania and Kosovo, the Turks are involved. And the Greeks and the Turks hate each other. And they have been at war on and off for generations, over Cyprus, over European Turkey, and the wars that have raged back and forth there over centuries. So tempers are running high. Remember how Jesus Christ said, and the nations were angry? The nations were angry. One of the prophecies of Isaiah also says that. And that is exactly the way the nations are right now today. The nations are angry. What has President Bill Clinton wrought. I'll tell you what he has done in one sense. In a matter of hours, he has virtually undone what every American administration from Dwight Eisenhower to George Bush had tried to accomplish, which is to thaw out the Russians, get the Russians and the Americans to cooperating together. I've actually stated time and again out of the pulpit, clear back in days when we had thousands of people come in Big Sandy, that you will live to see the time when the Soviet Union, as I called it then, and the United States are once again allied against a common foe. That would seem like going way out on some kind of a prophetic limb. It still may yet happen, but it will take a tremendous amount of restraint on the part of the Russians. And so far, they're showing a certain amount of restraint so far as the official government line itself. But they've done all these gestures, and they're not merely cosmetic, the way some of our news media will tend to look at it, just because the Russians like McDonald's. It may go a whole lot further than some people want to think. We think now, because we've got a lot of cooperation economically, that America is heavily invested, and a lot of people have brought this up already on the talk shows, we're giving Russians a lot of money. We're giving them a lot of aid. Sure, they're not going to cut off that aid. They're not going to react, you know, irresponsibly, and suddenly we'll just shut off the aid and we'll slap down an embargo on them. They won't get our help anymore. Well, sometimes people lose their tempers, and they just say, forget it all. Forget the aid and forget it all. Let's go. And I don't really know whether some of those who have darker suspicions about why Bill Clinton would practice selective morality, how he can progress from the state in which he found himself only a few weeks ago to being the moral conscience of the entirety of the world about all of these things happening in Kosovo. They're bad, they're hideous, they're horrible, but the Russians did something similar in Chechnya, and we stood by when Rwanda happened, and there were tens of thousands, I guess eventually hundreds of thousands, or close to a million that died and were butchered by machetes because they're not white Europeans. And the United States and UN virtually did nothing. They got on the scene after it was all over down in Rwanda. Some elements of the UN finally did. We practice selective morality. Every single year, the Congress votes the Chinese most favored nation status. In spite of 5,000 killed, maybe 10,000 more injured, some of them crushed to bits under the treads of tanks in Tiananmen Square only a few years ago when some students tried to get China to make some democratic reforms. China is not democratic, it is communist. It is totalitarian. It has a so-called dismal human rights record. But you don't mess with the largest nation on the face of the earth, with one quarter of the population of the earth, which also has nuclear arsenals, and now the means to deliver them to the United States, thanks to technology allowed to be squirreled away to China by the current administration, and in return for campaign finance funds that found their way to help get Bill Clinton elected the second time. There are an awful lot of people in the United States talking about this. All the talk shows, all kinds of people think that there's some kind of a cause and effect going on here, some kind of a relationship between this sudden attack. It's not sudden, they were warned, of course, but at least whatever pretext was mounted, and that it is a selective situation where there are no conceivable American interests other than the way you feel about citizens being murdered, and we all feel that way, as well we should. But is the United States a modern Roman Empire? Does the United States have legions? You know, legions were made up of mercenaries like illiterate Carthaginians. We don't send illiterate Carthaginians over to Kosovo or places like that to die. We send young American boys from Fort Scott, Kansas, and from Tyler, Texas, and from, you know, Eugene, Oregon. And they are the sons of mothers, and when one of them gets shot down, as one did, and hid out from some of those Serbs for several days and finally got rescued, we see his face and the entire nation is electrified by his escape story. On the other hand, when one of them got shot down and was beaten up by some of Saddam Hussein's army, and we saw his battered, bruised face on the front cover of Time magazine, the whole nation is in anguish and trauma, just like we were when the hostage crisis broke out in Iran. And we want to get that young man back home. We don't have mercenaries. Why should, when you stop to think about it, the United States of America, in its arrogance, believe that whatever little problem occurs anywhere on this good green earth, it is our task and our responsibility to go take care of it. We are the people who need to go down there and expend our money and our lives. By the way, every cruise missile costs what a nice corporate jet aircraft would cost. At least $1 million. Depending on the kind of cruise missile it is, maybe a whole lot more. And we've expended so many, and apparently there is no budget to provide for a whole lot more, that we don't have that many more of them in our arsenal. But every single time we bomb a barracks, it cost them $56,000 to build, that doesn't have a single member of their army in it. We did it with expending about $1 million in a cruise missile. So here's the United States pretending that we are the world's only superpower, which we are not. Russia is a superpower. China is a superpower. Germany and Europe are a great superpower. Britain is a superpower. Japan is a superpower and could be a gargantuan nuclear power in a matter of months, and may already have a nuclear program that you don't know anything about. It is absolutely nonsense for the United States of America, on the basis of this self-righteous morality, to trigger what could be the spark that unites a greater, wider Balkan war and results in terrible problems in the Middle East. Now let me read to you something that may be very cogent and very relevant. The United European government has called for a Palestinian state to be established within 1 year, not subject to any veto by any other states or organizations of states, by the UN or NATO or America or anybody else. Just yesterday morning, I believe it was, 15 leaders of the European Union signed an expected proclamation calling for the establishment of an independent, democratic Palestinian state within 1 year. Contradicting Israeli statements, the EU insisted that a democratic Palestinian state in the region, one that supports peace, oh sure, is the best security for peace in the area, especially for Israel. Can you imagine that reasoning? The key paragraph said EU countries, quote, reaffirm the continuing and unqualified Palestinian right to self-determination, including the option of a state, look forward to the early fulfillment of this right, appeal to the parties to strive in good faith for a negotiated solution on the basis of this right, which is not subject to any veto. Europe beginning to make big, strong statements about redrawing the map of the Middle East. How many decades have I said that Europe is going to someday begin to exercise the political power commensurate with its economic and industrial strength, and now its military strength? The EU, quote, expresses its conviction that the creation of a democratic, viable, and peaceful sovereign Palestinian state on the basis of existing agreements and through negotiations would be the best guarantee of Israel's security and Israel's acceptance as an equal partner in the region. But Benjamin Netanyahu disagreed and stated just Thursday that the question is not how we will live here, but if we will live here. Kind of chilling, isn't it? Because they go on to say what would be natural, what would be normal. Now, what would happen if the Palestinians in a patchwork, gerrymander-looking state, West Bank, Gaza, with some kind of access through Israel, were a separate state? What can a state do? Oh, it can sign treaties. It can sign pacts. It can sign mutual defense agreements. It can do business. It can engage in any kind of geopolitics it wishes. So therefore, in the case of either real problems or a pretext, what would prevent the Palestinian state from asking Saddam Hussein to send about half of his army in there to help them? Nothing. It would have that right. Every sovereign state has that right, especially if pacts and agreements are signed. Who will be the king of the South? Could it ever be a Palestinian? Could it be an Egyptian? I don't know. I don't know. But I know those prophecies are true. I know they're going to come to pass. I know that some king of the South, who probably is therefore an Arab, is going to do something that is going to trigger a violent European reaction. But look at that language again. The king of the south is who pushes at him, not anybody in Jerusalem. The king of the south is the person that starts the shoving match, but Jerusalem gets occupied. Now why? Here we've got a wave all around the world from Korea, from the time of the buffer zones of the DMZ between North and South Korea, to Vietnam and its so-called DMZ, demilitarized zone, to the peacekeepers that are all over the world from Panama to Bosnia-Herzegovina. It is in the air today that the United Nations is policing all of the regional hotspots and trouble spots by putting in troops from all kinds of nations that contribute to the UN, from Norway and Belgium to the United States and Germany. And so they are peacekeepers. They go in with their armored personnel carriers and their tanks and their cannon and their mortars and their machine guns, wearing a blue felt hat as a peacekeeper. Look now at the scriptures in Matthew 24 and the language of what Christ said about those who were in Judea. He said, when you see, verse 15, the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Verse 16, Matthew 24, then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house, neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. What does that tell you? That's like my daughter-in-law talking about her sister, when she hears the air raid warnings, having to run to her place of work, with all the emotion that that might trigger in her mind and Deanna's mind, to think of her sister having to run in fear because of an air raid siren. What does this tell you? You're not sitting here reading the news and saying in 2 years, this is not even NATO saying now we're probably going to attack within 24 hours. You know, in 24 hours, you got time to go back down and get the baby off the bed. You've got time to go get your clothing. You've got time to take some supplies. You've got time to get some survival gear. You've got time to get some food and water and put on a parka and head out into the snow. This is saying, let him that is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. He's on the roof. And he's been there, and all around him there have been occupying forces. Down there on a corner is an armored personnel carrier, and over here about a quarter of a mile is a tank, and he can see them. All of a sudden, with a rumble, he sees that the tank starts up, and the armored personnel carrier starts up. He hears a whistle, and he sees a bunch of helmeted people running and jumping in it with submachine guns on their shoulders. He sees something that triggers a thought in his mind, this prophecy is coming to pass. I'm up here on the roof trying to hang up clothing. I better just take the road of the roofs all the way to the end of the block and just kind of whistle and act like I'm going about my own business and not paying attention to anybody and just walk on out of here, or else I'm going to lose my life. Somebody's out in the field and they're working, and there's a house over there. Suddenly they hear, they sense something right immediately there in their neighborhood. They're not watching television, they're not reading a newspaper, they're not given any time. Something immediately in their neighborhood that has already been in place suddenly changes to where they say, I've got to get out of here or I'm going to die. And so Christ said, pray that you're not a woman in an advanced state of pregnancy, or that you're nursing a baby, because it's awful tough to grab a baby in arms and go. And the implication could be, too, that the woman is up on the roof hanging up the clothing and the baby is sleeping in a floor downstairs. But pray you that your flight be not in the winter, not like these Kosovans that have been walking around in knee-deep snow with not enough adequate clothing to keep warm over there, neither on the Sabbath day, for then shall be great tribulation such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. Now, come down to a scenario that I think makes a lot of sense. You all know that all the Arab countries would like nothing better than the extermination of the nation of Israel. And the people who would love to see that most of all are the Palestinian Arabs. They would like to have all that land, not just the West Bank, not just Hebron, not just the Gaza Strip. They like to have it all and get rid of all those Jews out of there. Peacekeeping is in the air. coalitions of governments contributing massive numbers of troops to keep the peace are in vogue. Would you think there ever be any reason or excuse, if there is the declaration of a separate Palestinian state in 2000, which there probably will be, Yasser Arafat's been threatening to do it this May, in about two more months. If that happens, and then if the Palestinian state government, PA, the Palestinian Authority, begins to negotiate with some of these other Arab states and begins to get heavier arms than the Israelis gave them, which are merely the shoulder, you know, AK-47 type of thing, and not even any heavy ammo, or, you know, they can't even have 50 caliber, but they've got basically just infantry type arms, and lots of them, I think 36,000, I forget. Then I can see where there might be some move against Israel, which would be interpreted as a pushing at the occupying or peacekeeping force that is there to preserve and protect them. Which nation would earn more kudos and accolades by saying, we are going to put a stop to the violence and to the massacre of Israeli citizens that have been going on here now, and going in there and stop it in the same way that NATO is trying to stop the massacre of Kosovans in Kosovo. If something like that happened, you can see what the pretext might be, what the reason might be for a multilateral European force to move into Palestine and to occupy it. Now, since Christ said, when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, that tells me the Pope will be involved. He also said, when you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, in Luke 21 and verse 20, then know the destruction thereof is nigh. So it all comes together to me in the light of extremely current political events and military events in the world. The stage is set for the Pope to begin to intervene in some of these regional conflicts. The Pope is scheduled to go to Israel in the year 2000. They're going to declare a Palestinian state, apparently in the year 2000. How long have we got? When is it all going to come together? When will we see some of these prophecies? Not just some prelude to it, like in the Balkans today, but actually the big prophecies beginning to come to pass as we've expected for all these decades. I don't know why, but my mind looks at all these scenarios and thinks of all these things and watches the news and looks at the history of it and the prophecies, and it just seems like we're getting awfully close to some very major events happening. I think that's why so many hundreds of people are turning to our website, and I think that's why people want to hear messages along this line to at least give them some kind of a warning. You know, Diana couldn't convince her mother that the bombs were about to fall, but I'll guarantee you when they did, they got the message. When you're in an apartment that shakes like a major earthquake is rattling, you know, a 2,000-pound bomb went off about a mile or so away, it'll scare you. You better hope that those things are awfully accurate and that they hit the military base if they're going to hit anything and not your apartment complex. So I just wanted to remind you of the dangerous times in which we live and see if some of you have been thinking along the same lines and you're watching what is happening over there. You know, we are told by Jesus Christ to watch and to pray always that we might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. I also thank you very much for those of you that have prayed for Deanna's sister and mother and her two nephews and their extended family. A large extended family over there, and for all those people. We ought to pray for all of them, for the Kosovars, for the people that horribly bereaved because of the atrocities that have been heaped upon them, and of course pray for God to bring peace. And the only way that's ever going to happen is for God to just send Jesus Christ to the earth and put down all these armies and to bring peace at last. That's the only way we're ever going to have world peace. It's not going to be brought about by the likes of these NATO attacks and Bill Clinton and the decision he made to bomb Yugoslavia.